Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst David McMichael, who assesses growing opposition to the Iraq War and signs that some members of Congress are getting the message. Wayne Smith, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., who talks about the recent arrests of Santiago Alvarez and Osvaldo Mitat, close allies of Cuban exile militant Luis Posada Carriles, and Steve Bradbury of ACORN, who discusses the ongoing debate about the reconstruction of hurricane-ravaged New Orleans. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year ago, Ukrainian businessman Andriy Chuprin put his life on hold to join the Orange Revolution. He marched with 500,000 fellow citizens for weeks in Kiev, demanding a new election in support of opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko. After 2.5 months of solid protests, a new election was ordered and the pro-Western Yushchenko was elected president of Ukraine. However, governing Ukraine proved difficult for the reformers. Yushchenko's administration got caught up in a corruption scandal, and his chief of staff, along with two key officials, resigned. Reacting to the scandal, Yushchenko fired the popular prime minister Yulia Tymoshenko and her cabinet. He also angered many in the Orange Revolution ranks by giving immunity to politicians who supported former Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, whose election to president was reversed during last winter's protests. Others accused Yushchenko of making behind-the-scenes deals with former government officials. With new elections set for March, Yushchenko's popularity in the polls has fallen to 33%, and the reform camp is split. The pro-Russian party backing a new campaign by Viktor Yanukovych has a small lead in opinion polls. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is on the list of possible candidates for the 2008 Republican nomination for president. Romney, a Mormon, is famous for organizing the Salt Lake City Games and for his stern opposition to same-sex marriage and stem cell research. In recent months, Romney has gotten favorable reviews in conservative publications like the Weekly Standard and the National Review. But Romney's membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, may cause him problems within the GOP. Many evangelicals, especially the Southern Baptist Convention, view Mormons as a cult, not much different from devil worship. In 1997, Southern Baptists sent out a special video and a book in a focused effort to convert Mormons in Salt Lake City. One minister, during the recruitment drive, called Utah a stronghold of Satan. Last winter, evangelical broadcaster Charles Colson told his radio listeners, "While Mormons share some beliefs with Christians, they are not Christians." Attacks on Mormons have worked in recent tight elections. In Arizona's 2002 governor's race, won by Democrat Janet Napolitano, Republican candidate Matt Salmon was hurt by TV ads run by a minor candidate that questioned his Mormon faith in the context of a breakaway sect of Mormons who practice polygamy on the Arizona-Utah border. Salmon lost 10 to 20 points in key evangelical districts. Every spring, 43-year-old North Carolina farm worker Felix Alvarez treats thousands of Christmas trees with Roundup, a powerful weed killer linked to cancer among applicators who are exposed to the chemical salt compound. The state of North Carolina produces an annual $100 million Christmas tree crop, accounting for one out of every five Christmas trees sold. In the process, mostly Latino workers are putting their health at risk handling some of the most toxic pesticides allowed under law. In 1999, the American Cancer Society issued a study showing cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma increased by 2.7 times among those who work closely with glyphosate, the herbicide sold under the trade name Roundup, made by the Scotts Miracle-Gro Company. According to E, the environmental magazine, the most hazardous chemical used in Christmas trees is dicystan 15G, a powder usually applied using a bucket and a measuring spoon. In 2004, its manufacturer, Bayer Crop Sciences, halted its use everywhere except on fir trees in North Carolina and coffee in Puerto Rico. To prevent an outright ban of dicystan 15G, North Carolina Christmas tree growers devised a closed application system. Some tree growers are using increased levels of other insecticides, which are considered moderately toxic but can cause headaches, dizziness, numbness, and many other unpleasant side effects. A recent public health study by Wake Forest Public Health Professor Thomas Arcuri found traces of pesticides in the homes of Christmas tree laborers, on the children's hands, toys, and in family urine samples. Another study concluded that although no case of long-term illness has been linked to Christmas tree farming in North Carolina, Arcuri found the scientific evidence is there to indicate an increased risk. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
Representative John Murtha, a conservative Democrat from Pennsylvania, shook up the status quo on Capitol Hill when he recently called for the speedy withdrawal of American forces from Iraq. Murtha, a decorated Vietnam War veteran and an ally of the Pentagon on most military issues, originally supported President Bush's Iraq War, but came to the conclusion that the U.S. occupation of Iraq only fuels the insurgency and nothing more could be accomplished. For many months now, public opinion in the U.S. has been turning against the Iraq War. Growing numbers of Americans feel the war itself has not been worth the price paid in blood and money, and are in favor of ending U.S. involvement in the conflict. Indicative of the widespread sentiment that President Bush lied the nation into war, a Harris poll conducted on November 23rd found that 64% of Americans believe that the Bush administration generally misleads the American public on current issues to achieve its own ends. While Congressman Murtha has taken a bold position opposing the Iraq War, many other Democrats, including Senator Hillary Clinton and former presidential candidate John Kerry, have offered no alternative to the Bush policy. And while the White House talks about staying the course in Iraq, administration officials have begun to talk about troop withdrawals in advance of the 2006 congressional midterm election. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst David McMichael, who assesses the growing opposition to the Iraq War and the debate now underway in Congress.
You're in a no-win situation in Iraq. There seems to be solid agreement on that. Despite the forthcoming so-called elections that will be held in Iraq, that the main focus of discontent within the country is in fact the presence of an foreign occupying force, that is, which is 95% United States military. You know, if that military leaves, much of the reason for the insurgency will disappear. The arguments made is that the current insurgency will morph, if you will, change into a civil war with the Kurds in the north, the Shiites in the south, and the Sunni Arabs in the center, fighting bitterly over who is going to control the country. And this is not, by the way, the first time this would happen in the relatively short and usually quite unhappy history of Iraq. But the point I think that one can make is that if Iraq, in fact, splits into three parts, is that necessarily a disaster? Because all we have to do is look at the rest of the region, which is, in fact, consists of any number, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Kuwait, and so forth, of small-sized oil countries, and one way or another, they all seem to function. I could add Yemen to that as well. They're not places I'd really care to do my retirement in, but they do function. We've been able to adapt to that situation. Matter of fact, the United States was just involved very heavily only a dozen years ago in a rather ill-considered effort to break up another country into small constituent parts, and that was Yugoslavia. So, yes, this can be lived with. That's not an unmitigated disaster.
With the exception of John Murtha, very few Democrats are standing up and saying those very important words that they believe it's time for the U.S. to withdraw troops from Iraq. John Kerry, the Democratic presidential candidate, backed away from John Murtha's statement very quickly. Where is the Democratic Party at now? Do they need to articulate some vision of some policy alternative on Iraq before this next election coming up?
Well, I don't know if they need to, but I would certainly advise them to if they hope to gain a majority in the Congress. But given the positions which the Democrats have been taking, and just to focus on Iraq and foreign policy, for that matter, would it make a whole lot of difference? The most hawkish of the whole group is Hillary Clinton right now, who obviously has presidential ambitions. I mean, she's not going to be out-hawked. And I don't see many people, with some honorable exceptions, Maxine Waters and others, you know, who have taken any sort of a responsible, or at least for me, a responsible approach to this. And I think it's really within a larger context, Scott. And when a president chooses to go outside what seem to be pretty clear constitutional limits, and to continue justifying this on the grounds that he is commander-in-chief, is a considerable temptation for people to get into what they would call a permanent state of war. And in fact, in describing the situation in which we are in as a permanent war against terror, I think you can see how far down the road we go.
How important at this juncture in the Iraq war is citizen action, given that the Democrats are very reluctant to take a strong position on withdrawal of the Iraq war? Certainly the Bush administration is nowhere near making a decision on withdrawal of troops. What would you say citizens can most effectively do now who oppose this war?
You know, the most effective thing, my opinion, that citizens can do is to continue to make their presence felt. Get out there, organize, to be on the street, that's one thing, be visible. The second thing is to keep flooding your representatives with your opinions on this, and make it very clear that you either pledge to stop supporting this war, to get out, and to not put us in this situation of unconstitutional warfare making again, or we are not voting for you. And I think that the position of the majority of the politicians in both parties are identical on this. It's no good saying to people, oh, this will only help the Republicans and hurt the Democrats. Well, I don't think the Democrats are going to reform unless they get hurt.
That was former CIA analyst David McMichael. He serves on the steering group of Veteran Professionals for Sanity. Read his articles online at commondreams.org. On the night of Friday, November 18th, on a tip from a government informant, Santiago Alvarez and Osvaldo Mitat were arrested in Miami on weapons charges. Alvarez, a wealthy real estate owner, was found by federal agents to have in his Broward County apartment complex a secret cache of weapons, including hand grenades, unregistered silencers, automatic weapons with obliterated registration numbers, and explosives. Mitat was also found to possess weapons after a government informant made a delivery to him in Miami. ATF agents also found more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition, more explosives and automatic weapons in a vault in the building management office. Both Alvarez and Mitat are longtime allies of Luis Posada Carriles, the Cuban exile militant accused by the Cuban and Venezuelan governments to have masterminded, along with Orlando Bosch, the bombing of the Cubana Airlines flight from Barbados in 1976. That act of terrorism killed all 73 people on board, including members of the Cuban youth fencing team. Posada is also accused of planning a series of hotel bombings in Havana between 1997 and 1998. Both Santiago Alvarez, 64, and Osvaldo Mitat, 63, were among the five passengers aboard the fishing boat Santrina, which Fidel Castro has maintained smuggled Posada into the United States through Mexico in March. Posada is currently incarcerated on immigration charges. Cuban-American National Foundation President Francisco Pepe Hernandez charged the Bush administration with betrayal, saying the White House is forgetting the promises they made to the exile community and are instead catering to Castro's demands. In late October, U.S. Customs intercepted a FedEx package sent to Alvarez's Hialeah office from Fernando Valdez in Guatemala. It contained a book titled Cuba Mia, and hidden inside was a fake Guatemalan passport. Wayne Smith is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. Your reporter, Denise Manzari, talked with Smith about the implications of these recent arrests.
It's a very interesting development. They have arrested Santiago Alvarez, who was a very close friend and ally and financial supporter of Luis Posada Carriles. Like, he was the guy who paid for the boat when they were going down early on. They were going down to assassinate Fidel Castro before the Panamanian expedition. The police, the FBI, went into his home and they found all kinds of arms and silencers and explosives and so forth. And so he has been arrested. And another associate of Posada Carriles. Now, what is that all about? It's heartening to see someone being brought to justice, some guy involved in terrorist activities being brought to justice. But what are the implications of this for the Posada Carriles case? Is it simply a matter of the FBI trying to demonstrate that it's doing the right thing here, that you can't just get away with everything? Difficult to say, but I come back to the fact that it's difficult to see how they can do anything but release Posada Carriles. I don't see any charge they could bring up now that would stick. So very interesting to watch, but while it's heartening to see that Santiago Alvarez and the others were arrested, I can't see that this means that this is the portent of some strong move against Posada Carriles.
And what do you think it means for them? I mean, they're actually, the Miami community is calling for their release.
Well, of course, the Miami community is calling for their release. And, I mean, it's almost, you have to laugh. Some of the hardliners in the Miami community are saying, well, the U.S. government always does everything that Fidel Castro wants. What? I mean, the U.S. government doing anything that Fidel Castro wants. If they have moved against Santiago Alvarez, it is not to please Fidel Castro, but for some other calculation on the part of the Bush administration and of law enforcement agencies.
It's ironic that the full-page ad came out in the New York Times on the 18th. It's a really strange coincidence that both Mitad and Alvarez were arrested over the weekend.
Yes.
And the Posada Carriles issue is ongoing as well. And it's very interesting to see how this is going to play out.
Absolutely.
I'm just wondering what the motivation is, what the plan is with all three of them.
Exactly. So we'll be pondering this for days to come.
I think we will. Although Alvarez had told his attorney that Castro, it's a shame or it's unfortunate that Castro has initiated this.
Yeah,
so he,
no,
you know,
right.
He's blaming him for that as well. Any final thoughts on this, Wayne Smith, before we close out?
No, I think the most important thing is what will the government do with Posada Carriles? Are they going to shelter him? Are they going to allow him to remain here? And if so, our credibility really goes out the window. When we say to other governments, you must not shelter terrorists, they say, but you are. We are supposed to be in an all-out campaign against international terrorism. And the president has said on a number of occasions that anyone who shelters a terrorist is a terrorist. Any government that shelters terrorists must be considered a terrorist government. And yet, here we are with Luis Posada Carriles, an arch-terrorist in the United States. He's here because a number of congressional representatives from South Florida, Ileana Ross Leighton and Mario and Lincoln Diaz-Balart, went to the Panamanian government and asked that he be pardoned. He was in Panama because he was in prison in Panama because he was there to assassinate Fidel Castro. Castro was going to give a speech. Posada Carriles and a number of others were going to blow up the sports center where he was to give the speech. There would have been about 1,500 people there. They had enough C4 explosives to bring the whole thing down. So he was in prison in Panama. But these congressional representatives from South Florida went to the outgoing president of Panama, asked that she pardon them, and she did. And Posada Carriles is in the United States now as a result of that. The Bush administration has not moved to declare him a terrorist. He was accused of illegal entry and is here, and I think we'd have to say up to this point, is being sheltered by the Bush administration. So what does that say about our campaign against terrorism?
That was Wayne Smith, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. For more information, call CIP at area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. Steve Bradbury is the lead New Orleans organizer with ACORN, a community organization that fights for the rights of low and moderate income families. He was recently awarded the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award for his efforts on behalf of the poorest victims of Hurricane Katrina. The award typically goes to human rights activists overseas. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spent 2 weeks in New Orleans in mid-November. While there, she saw lots of ACORN signs in flood-damaged neighborhoods that proclaimed, "No bulldozing." ACORN is fighting for the right of poor and working-class residents of New Orleans, who have yet to return to the city, to have some say in how their property is handled and the land redeveloped. ACORN opposes a bill introduced in Congress by Louisiana Republican Representative Richard Baker to create a Louisiana Recovery Corporation that would give property owners options to sell and repurchase their land at a later date while financing infrastructure improvements so properties can be redeveloped. ACORN says the Recovery Corporation in its present form would exclude those most affected by the disaster and lead to gentrification of neighborhoods where pre-Katrina housing was mostly minority-owned and working class. Melinda Tuhu spoke with Steve Bradbury about the politics of reconstructing New Orleans and the meaning behind the "No Bulldozing" signs that were posted by his group as floodwaters receded and debate was running high about how to rebuild the city.
At that time in particular, there was a lot of talk about just raising the whole area. And so basically that was a way of allowing, of voicing the opinion that people don't want to just have their properties bulldozed, that people should have the right to come in and look at their house prior to anybody making any type of decision about it. The thing is that in the lower ninth ward, you're talking about, there's a specific area, and that's between Claiborne and Desire Street, where you have, you know, an extremely high number of, you know, houses that cannot really be, that have to be rebuilt. There are other areas of the Lower Ninth Ward that have, where you could actually go in and refurbish the buildings, you know, gut them out, and then rebuild them from the inside out. They're structurally sound. They just have the mold damage and whatever water damage there is. People say the Ninth Ward needs to be torn down. And what a lot of people outside of New Orleans don't realize is that the Ninth Ward covers an awful lot of territory, the majority of which does not need to be torn down, that can be brought back.
When I visited the Ninth Ward, the Lower Ninth Ward, there was just block after block of utter devastation, and it seemed that there was nothing else you could do but bulldoze the whole area, clear it off, and start over. But ACORN doesn't agree with that?
Our position is always in terms of the people who are going to be the most affected should play a role in the decision-making around that. And what we hear from people over and over again is that people want to come home. They want to be able to see their properties. And a lot of people want to rebuild. They don't want, you know, a lot of people from New Orleans love New Orleans. And you move somewhere else, there are so many facets of New Orleans culture that are missing in other cities that people want to be back home. And so if you're going to talk about a neighborhood and what should be the future of that neighborhood, that conversation cannot go on if the people who live in that neighborhood are not participating in the conversation. And that's what's happening right now.
There was a Louisiana Recovery and Rebuilding Conference that took place in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago. It actually happened while I was there, but I didn't know about it until right after it happened. So I was reading about it just today online, and it seemed that virtually every speaker was a white male. There was like one woman and one man of color.
I don't know if they posted or not, but they did a survey at the beginning of that conference that showed that it was almost 70% white male making more than $80,000 a year. That's hardly representative of the city of New Orleans.
New Orleans is 8 to 12 feet below sea level, and much of it's in a floodplain. And the wetlands that have protected it in the past are disappearing rapidly. So what do you think should happen now? Maybe there shouldn't be houses in the lowest parts of the city.
The flooding that occurred in the lower Ninth Ward was not due to the hurricane. It had nothing to do with a floodplain and everything to do with the failure of the levee, right? They breached. In the lower Ninth Ward, there was a barge that broke through the levee. If we're going to speak about this rationally, that was not even a floodplain issue. Right? There's a negligence issue on whatever corporation left that barge in the canal, you know, while there was a hurricane coming. And then there's also a lot of discussion, as I'm sure you're well aware by now, of the inefficiency of the levees that were put there, and that it was a long time coming that they knew that those levees were not strong enough and didn't do anything about it. It's important that we look at why the flooding occurred, because what's happening is a low-income neighborhood that had a majority home ownership is going to be penalized not because they suffered a natural disaster, but because the security that they were supposed to have been afforded by their government wasn't given them. And we kind of really have to hold that point out in front, because as long as we move to these side discussions and we allow for that neighborhood and for the properties and the homeowners in that neighborhood to be cheated.
That was Steve Bradbury, lead New Orleans organizer with ACORN. Contact ACORN by calling 1-800-239-7379 or visit the group's website at www.acorn.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.